IATSE Local 891 presents Apple Box Talks,
the podcast where we get to talk to the very best in entertainment, the artists and technicians of 891.
From prep to post and everything in between, we create worlds on screens of all sizes. Welcome to Apple Box Talks. I'm Crystal.
And I'm Hillary. And today we're taking a deep dive into the department full of creative problem solvers, creating the spaces where the drama unfolds.
With credits to his name, such as Housekeeping, There Will Be Blood, and Lincoln. Please welcome Academy Award-winning set decorator, Jim Erickson.
So pull up an Apple Box and let's talk.
Welcome, Jim. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Thank you.
So, Jim, you have an incredible list of films that you have participated in. And in all of that, you were very consistent. You didn't jump around like a lot of people do. You were a set decorator. Can you explain to our listeners how you started out?
I had moved to Vancouver. It was 1976. And I got some work at CBC Television in the art department down there. Then they were busy. And then I think, 1989, a lot of people at CBC art department were leaving to go into the independent industry, which has started to move in Vancouver. It was very slow. Those first couple of years, if you did one or two pictures, and it was all movies at that time, one or two a year was a good year. And then it started escalating and building. And these art department people with whom I had worked at CBC in Vancouver, there was a designer, Doug Higgins, and prop guy, Jimmy Chow, that asked me to work on a film. And I said, they said, you want to be a set decorator? And I said, sure. So I did. And that's got the start.
That's wonderful. And you really, in your accomplished career, have hit the absolute pinnacle of your work. Can you talk to us right off the top here about Lincoln and what it was like to work on a project of that magnitude?
Lincoln was the most satisfying. I mean, we basically had the White House, and then we had, 8 or 9 or 10 other kind of sets, minor sets, all complicated. But it was one of those projects where everything kind of fell into place and fell into place beautifully. You know, you just kind of, you know, when I started on it, I said, well, where am I going to get the wallpaper for these sets? Because all the wallpaper back then was hand silk screened and they had metallics in it and things like that. And you know, you'd have to play thousands and thousands of dollars to get it from a design company, and it would be plasticized and it would be awful. And then I learned that in Richmond, Virginia, there's this little mom and pop operation that was still hand silk squeezing wallpapers.
Wow.
And they did all the wallpaper for the Lincoln White House. I mean, things like that would happen. And it's like, whew, I'd always wanted to have my own wallpaper hand silk screened, and it did.
Wow.
Before I did it. And, you know, other things happened. Like I was out shopping for bedding for Mary Lincoln Todd's bedroom. And I'd go to these antique shows and things around Richmond and the mid-Atlantic states. And was at this one, and I came across this one stall. She had linens. I was looking, and there was a beautiful set of linens that were embroidered M.T. Mary Todd M.T.L.
Wow.
Nice Mary Todd Lincoln. I said, well, I mean, well, but this is unheard of. Hand embroidered, wonderful antique linens on her bed.
That's fantastic. And just because I'm such a, as many people are, a super fan of Daniel Day-Lewis, what was it like to kind of set the scene around a character that he was playing?
Daniel, this is the third movie that I did with him. And each movie was a wonderful experience. He's a wonderful man, hardworking. He never asked anything more of you than he would do himself. And he would, because he got to know me eventually after three movies, he did come and ask if he could get, if I could set up a little office in his apartment that he was staying at with some period pens and things like that, so he could just practice writing. And I did all that. And he was very grateful. He wasn't too demanding. It was, you know, it wasn't like, oh my God, I need a reproduction of my office so I can feel it. He just felt everything. I mean, the guy is such a consummate performer and very nice. I mean, on Lincoln, I didn't notice it so much on There Will Be Blood, but on Lincoln, he was quite adamant that we refer to him as Mr. Lincoln or Mr. President. And we did. I mean, it was, well, that's not difficult because he was. I mean, I remember the first, when we were opening the set, the big White House set, I think it was the first day of shooting, actually. And I was just doing a walkthrough to be sure that I kind of liked everything was where it was supposed to be. And then suddenly I'm walking down the major hallway, and then suddenly there's this, I could feel this presence beside me. I couldn't see it. It was just back and beside me. And it was this physical presence of Daniel Day-Lewis, kind of slope-shouldered, clumping down the hallway. And it was, you know, President Lincoln, as far as I was concerned. It was, but he was that type of person. Very nice to work with.
I think it's so interesting because so often people think of set dressing as what the audience is seeing, but it's really also about working in a partnership with the actors because you provide so much of what they're acting with and to. You're creating that space for them to just expand and fill it with that character, right?
Oh, I think so. It was very important for me in my throughout my entire career that you know, when someone, well, how do you know if you've done a good set? And I always said, well, it has to work for me visually and physically. It has to work for the actor so they feel they know where they are, that they're comfortable with their surrounding, that nothing jars for them. But it also has to work for the crew. The crew has to move around. The crew has to get in there and do it, you know. So those are what I always consider a successful set when it worked for everybody. Yeah. I don't care what it looked like. I mean, as long as it looked like it was supposed to.
And you have quite the reputation, actually, for being the researcher who will find out the little details that no one thought to think of, like the book that was on Lincoln's desk.
Yeah, no, I love the detail. I love the detail of life. And that is, I'm very curious about the details of life. And I remember we were getting into Lincoln's office set. And I said, I wonder what he would be reading. And I don't know how I found out, but I called the Lincoln Library Library in Springfield, Illinois. And I said, is there any record of what Lincoln was reading during this period of the, you know, that were in of his life that were in the story? And there was. There was an extended list of the things he was reading. So we got original copies properly edited for editions for that period and had them on the set. It was fun. Wow. It was quite the easy thing to do.
You know, one of my favorite sets of yours from There Will Be Blood, which is a fantastic movie also, is the bowling alley. And obviously lots of stuff goes down at the bowling alley. But, you know, just the way it was created to be so narrow and so, you know, one way you know, do you have any sort of details about how that came to be?
Oh, yeah, it was quite interesting, actually, because when I started on the film, there wasn't really an ending to the film. There was rumors of going to be this. And then the rumors started there was going to be a bowling alley. And what had happened is that Paul Anderson had scouted this location, the Gray Mansion in Los Angeles, which was built by them, that oil man about whom the film was based. It's quite a popular film location in Los Angeles. And they were scouting the house, the main house, things like that. And then someone said, do you want to see the bowling alley? And there was an old bowling alley that was in pretty, really rough shape. And so I think part of the deal was is that we restored the bowling alley for them. And then we shot there. And I think I mean, I'm not 100% positive, but I'm pretty sure that after he saw that bowling alley, Paul Anderson found the ending for the movie there. I mean, so it was kind of inspired by something he saw.
So where did you build the interest and skills in working in your craft prior to moving into the industry? Did you have any previous skills, or did you always just know you wanted to jump into production designing?
I never dreamed about getting into the film industry. I think after I graduated from high school, I went to college, a little college in Minnesota. I grew up in Minnesota, and I ended up in the drama department. I tried out for a play, got into it. I was trying other things and couldn't find anything that I connected with, and I ended up on stage, and I love the theater. I still do. And I did three summers of summer stock theater. And when you're not on stage, particularly at this college summer stock, you were building sets, painting sets, hanging lights, and doing all those things, building props. So I got a taste of all that, stage technical things. And I liked it. I was not afraid of it. Some people go into it and they want to be an actor or something. They're kind of leery of the technical things. I wasn't. I embraced them. And so I think when I went to the hiring department at CBC and I had a fair amount of stage experience, I think that's how more they hired me. They were busy. They were desperate. They hired me.
So I think, just to elaborate more for maybe the people listening, sometimes for people first coming in, they pour their heart and soul into making a particular prop or designing a particular thing. And then they watch the finished product and say, oh, that was on screen for 10 seconds. How do you speak to that kind of where your role exists in the place in the industry, like the context of what you do?
Yeah, I understand. Well, I've had some huge experiences where I had to create an entire fairgrounds one time that was never shot, and kind of go, well, you know, it's not my problem. I did what I'm supposed to do, and I'm only a small part of this. This film is a big society that gets together to create this thing, and we all have our little parts to it to make it work, and. It never really bothered me that, you know, some of the best work I did never got on screen. So what? It's not my problem. I did it. I know I did it. And I enjoyed the process of doing that as much as anything that got on set. And that was always my, I think my love of the industry was not so much the finished product, but the process of getting there. I loved the process. I loved the research, and I loved just assembling these sets and getting them to work. You know, once I stepped away, I mean, I easily stepped away from a set and said, it's yours.
Yeah. And you talk about one of the challenging parts is of the film industry are egos. And so, you know, there's a lot of different sorts of people in various roles, and you have to be able to work with all of them. So, you know, you've assembled quite a few teams over the years. What is it you most look for in your teams?
Curiosity. I want teams that are curious. And the other thing is, I think I said in that honesty. I mean, accidents happens all the time, but you know, I just want to know and don't try to cover it up. And I learned very early in my career that, it sounds hackneyed and old folksy, but honesty is the best policy. And boy, I have disarmed so many producers by saying, I need your help.
What is it that really sustained you throughout your career? What kept you going? What kept you motivated?
I really looked for things that challenged me. I looked for things that were challenging visually, socially, and that kept me going. I mean, and luckily my partner at the time, he said, you know, you don't need, you're miserable when you're doing something you don't like doing. So just don't do them. And from that point on, I really never did anything I didn't want to do.
Can you think of anyone who you mentored under or someone who specifically guided you through?
Well, the first one was Jimmy Chow, prop man extraordinaire. Still the finest prop man I've ever worked with in my entire career.
Yeah.
Of someone who really cared, someone who was really, really dedicated to getting the right perfect thing and wouldn't stop until the cameras rolled. Taught me a tremendous amount. And it probably wasn't, if it wasn't for him, I probably wouldn't have gotten in the business. Another one, a couple of directors, Alan Parker. I very early in my career, I did a Mississippi Burning, which was quite a major film of that year. Mm-hmm. And he just taught me so much about set, not in a professorial way. It was just like, he said, I don't want to see any whites on the set. I don't want to see any whites. I don't want to see any blues. And I don't want to see any orange. And I've never used white, blues, or orange since. Because they're annoying colors. Unless it's something really scripted that needs to be that. And there are blues that are beautiful, and there are, it's that Toys R Us blue that we all hate. So there was Alan Parker was really key. Michael Mann is one of those love-hate relationships. He taught me a lot about, we did three films together, and all three of them were difficult for me. Him too, I'm sure. He was very demanding, but he taught me how to really focus the presentation, how to talk to somebody who is not the easiest person in the world to talk to and say, this is what I plan to do. Is this all right? You know, because he demanded that he know exactly what's going on these sets. And so I invented a system, and I think it's pretty well used a lot now. And I'm out of the business, so I don't know, but I started seeing more and more of it, where I'd have these 4x4, 4 foot by 4 foot black foam core cards. And I would assemble a set on the card, a fabric sample, pictures of furniture, small, whatever scripted, you know, pictures and choices of that. And I'd take them to Michael Mann and I would say, this is what I'm thinking for this set. And we would talk about it. And so there was no surprises, you know, there was no, I know set decorators and I worked when I was early in my career who wanted to have a big surprise, not let anybody know what they're doing. And I never understood that. So what if they don't like it? Oh, then you have to scramble and waste a lot of money, you know.
Is there anyone that you really wish you would have worked with that you hadn't?
Yeah, the Coen brothers. I wanted to do a picture. I almost did one, but then it got canceled. It was too expensive or something. But I enjoy their work. I think they have a nice sense of humanity and a nice sense of humor, and they're from Minnesota, so I felt we could talk about our lives in Minnesota.
It's so good to hear the way you talk about the collaboration and the shared learning experience, because so much of what we do is interlaced. And I have to admit, after reading through your list of films, I went to look at a couple of the making of featurettes, and you're in almost all of them because you're shoulder to shoulder with the director or with an actor. And it just illustrates so perfectly those symbiotic relationships.
Yes. And yes, and again, quite early in my career, I was working on a movie, and I didn't decorate this one set, but a set was decorated. I was on set that morning, and there was this, you know, there was a sofa and a chair. It was a living room kind of thing. And the sofa and the chair, it was in 1950s, I believe, or something, were kind of a plaid fabric. They looked nice. They were appropriate and everything else. The lead actress comes onto the set. She's in a clashing plaid dress. and the costume designer says, "I'm not changing mine." and I said, "Well, let me see if I can." And I found a blanket or something. And it just taught me this really huge lesson that you've got to talk to these people, that you've got to let them know. And so I always invited the costume designer up and just show them the textiles I was using for drapes and furniture and things like that. And some of my best friends in the industry were costume designers. They liked that. They appreciated that. Mm-hmm. I think I liked it. I don't want to create a fuss and delay shooting. God forbid you delay shooting.
So I'm really gleaning from this conversation, the word curiosity and communication comes up most frequently.
Yeah.
And so those are pretty, you know, those are soft skills that we talk about that are very necessary, in accomplishing your craft, because it is a collaborative process, and those two skills are not necessarily, obvious when you're filling out your permittee application. So what specifically would you say to someone looking to, you know, put their permittee application in?
Do it. And you'll find out very quickly if you like what you're doing. You won't know until you get a chance to do it. But if you're successful, you'll get asked to do it again. If you're not, you'll probably be sitting at home wondering, why am I not, the phone not ringing, you know? But I think, you know, do it and hang around and get to know. And I always tell people, you know, I get this, it's this mother look that I get at parties once in a while, or you're at some kind of affair and this woman starts walking over you, kind of middle-aged, whatever. And you know, she's going to ask, how does I get my son or daughter into set decorating? Now, what school? The first question, well, what university did you go to study? I said, I didn't go to any. I have no degrees. And they got to go, what do you mean? You know, don't you need a degree in this? And I said, it'd probably be helpful, but I don't have a degree. I said, I said, what you need is experience. And what the way to get experience, the way we did, I don't know if they could still do it this way. But we did commercials. We did anything that we could to work with crews. And then crews would graduate out of commercials and then go into the feature industry in Vancouver. And they would often take their person with them. So that's why I always say, if you're going to a college and you know, into a film degree or something, get on a crew. Because if that person gets a contract to do a film or something, he's going to want people he knows and trusts to get on that crew. So that's how it kind of works through. It's all about experience. I don't think I haven't read a book that I think is a good set decorating book, to be honest. Maybe I should write it.
Well, that's a good idea.
I would read that book.
I'm wondering, on a personal note, where does one store an Academy Award?
Oh, it's just on a shelf in there. Okay. It was really interesting. When I, the day or two after I got the Academy Award, I get this call from a local friend here on Salt Spring. And he says, well, now you have to have a security system in your house. Because we live a very laissez-faire kind of life here. I said, security system, what for? Well, you know, you have that Oscar. I said, there's no value to an Oscar. You can't sell an Oscar. It's highly illegal, and it's the copyright protection, and you have to sign all sorts of things when you receive it. And the thing is, if you want to get rid of it, you have to sell it back to the Academy for a dollar.
Oh, wow. Can you bequeath it?
What
can
is
you
it?
Pass it down?
Oscar, who cares? Pardon?
Can you pass it down?
I think you can.
Yeah.
I don't have anybody to pass it to. Nobody I want to. Maybe I'll leave it to the museum here on Salt Spring Island. Mm. No, I don't know what I'll do. I don't know. I mean, I have so many nieces and nephews. It would be unfair to give them to one. I need to give each of them one.
Yeah. One gets the globe, one gets the arm.
You know, what young people, it's difficult to advise young people that have ideas about the film industry and things like that. And I don't know what I would do, to be honest, about how to advise people to pursue a career in set decorating, because it was so non-planned. I didn't have a plan, and I didn't have an objector. You know, people often said, well, you know, why did you stay as a set decorator? And why didn't you become a production? A lot of decorators do. We move into production design. And I say, why? I get asked to do some of the most interesting pictures going right now. Why would I want to production design some flunky movie of the week? Because that would be the next job. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to do that. I wanted to be part of something that excited me and I felt was worth doing, and that I could contribute my talents, whatever they are, to this. I'm not even sure what talents one needs for this. I mean, it helps be able to, I have very rudimentary drawing skill. I can't draw at all, but it's reading drawings and understanding them. I can, you know, pull my weight, but they're not very exciting. And that's important. But I think just being curious and this, you know, when we started out, there was no cell phones. Pages just came out. There was no copy machines. You had your telephone and you had your vehicle to get around and find things. You couldn't Google things and order online, which is wonderful. I'm glad you can, because you can get some great stuff. But I mean, and what it did is honed this telephone skill, where you would somehow find a contact that may know something about what you're looking for. You call them and they say, oh, sorry, don't have anything, don't know what you're talking about. And I said, well, then the technique was, well, might you know someone who does? And you just kept following and following. And always there was someone who specializes in what you're asking, in the question you are asking, or what you're looking for. Mm-hmm. Somebody somewhere does. You just have to find them.
You make a great point. It's, you know, no matter what position you're in, you really, it's a job, it's a career you have to bring yourself to. It's not just going to happen. You're not just going to get the calls.
You definitely are not. At least I don't think so. I mean, when you're so busy in Vancouver, I know a lot of people are coming off the streets, but usually they have some kind of artistic experience, or they're just not coming from the plowed field into the film industry. Although it probably would help if they did sometimes. But, and there's a sense of being practical. I mean, you know, people budgeting another good thing about after I learned how to budget a film, I was very good at budgeting, and I seldom ran into problems with my budget. And that's when I learned the trick. If you are looking like you're heading for a big hole there, you better go to the producer and say, I need help. Mm-hmm. And they love it.
Well, thank you so much, Jim. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been a joy.
I got gardening to think about and the dog to take care of, so.
Thanks again so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you for your interest. I appreciate that.
It's been lovely to speak with you, Jim. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's a wrap for another episode of Apple Box Talks.
For more episodes and to find your fit in the film and TV industry, check out ourwork.ca.